from space-time circuit Hamiltonians. It's a bit of a mouthful. Almost every ingredient of it is kind of a mouthful, so hopefully we can try and make sense of that in the next hour. This is joint work with Elizabeth Crossan, who is a professor at the University of New Mexico, Jim Minerke, who is a grad student at UC Berkeley, and Henry Yuen, who was here about a month ago talking about related work, who is a professor at the University of Toronto. Okay, so I guess the best way of summarizing our results are that we have a technique that turns any quantum error correcting code into an approximate quantum error correcting code. There's the ground space of a non-commuting, frustration-free Hamiltonian. And this technique can use good quantum error correcting codes. When I say good, that has a technical term which has the meaning of having a constant encoding rate and at least linear distance. We have a good quantum error correcting code, we feed it in its construction, and if it has a polylogarithmic depth encoding circuit, what you obtain is a local code Hamiltonian, so the code space is the ground space of this code Hamiltonian, with polylogarithmic interaction degree, with a ground space that is an approximate quantum error correcting code. And the parameters for this quantum error correcting approximate code are good up to polylogarithmic corrections, and we'll get into what exactly that entails. And these codes are approximate. They're approximately LDBC and approximately good. Another contribution of this work is it contains a new gap analysis technique for space-time circuit Hamiltonian, which we'll take a look at.
What does it mean for a code to be approximate?
Yeah, so let's go over that. So everything here is very approximate. Approximate means several different things, depending on which part of the aspect of the code we're talking about. So our codes are approximately codes. They're not even, you know, full bona fide codes. What that means is that, our recovered state after doing the decoding process is within some epsilon, which for us is 1 over polylog, and trace distance to the original encoded state. So in a normal quantum error correcting code, you would always recover your original encoded state perfectly. Here you get a state that's epsilon distance to it. But our codes are approximately LDPC. So what does LDPC mean? LDPC stands for low density parity check. And so a classical LDPC code is one where every bit participates in a, so every parity check that makes up the code uses a acts non-trivially on a constant number of bits. And also every bit participates in a constant number of parity checks that define the code. In the quantum setting, what that's going to mean is that every term of the code Hamiltonian is going to act on a constant number of qubits, and every qubit is acted on non-trivially by a constant number of these code Hamiltonian terms, which are, you can think of as projectors. And then so, what it means to be approximately LDPC then is that each qubit participates not in a constant number of Hamiltonian terms, which we can call checks. What happened?
No.
Good on my screen. Okay. Instead of participating in a constant number of Hamiltonian terms or checks, it participates in a polylogarithmic number of checks, and usually for a quantum LDPC code, we would have commuting checks, because they're usually thought of as being based on, they are CSS stabilizer codes. But we're relaxing that definition to allow our code to have non-commuting Hamiltonian terms, so non-commuting, what we would call parity checks. But our Hamiltonian is still frustration-free, okay? And the codes are approximately good, like the saying goes, good, not great. Our codes are approximately good, not good. And so what that means is that instead of linear distance and constant rate, we have a linear distance and constant rate up to multiplicative polylog correction. So in particular, the distance of our code is going to be n over log to the 5n, and the rate also has a 1 over log 5n correction to the constant encoding rate. And using this code, we can approximately detect errors. So what that means is we can use a measurement, which is of polylogarithmic circuit complexity, that acts on a polylogarithmic number of qubits. And if we do that, the error is detected with a probability that approaches unity. But it's not exactly unity, so we can approximately detect errors. So four senses in which our code is approximate. Okay, so what was the motivation for this work? Well, it's the quantum LDPC conjecture. Matt asks, you know, do there exist CSS stabilizer codes with constant rate, linear distance, local sparse stabilizer generators? And the reason this is an important question is that, you know, Daniel Gottesman, I think in 2009, showed that if we have quantum LDPC codes with good parameters, then we can do fault-tolerant quantum computation with pretty low overhead. So, you know, people have been trying to come up with such LDPC codes. But, right.
And it was 2013.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Alex. And so, you know, different people have been trying to make progress on this, and the way we try and make progress is by going beyond the paradigm of exact codes. We're using approximate codes instead, and we're seeing if that buys us anything. And also going beyond the definition of an LDPC code having to be a stabilizer code. So, you know, our parity checks, so to speak, do not commute with one another. It matters in which order you measure them, which makes things complicated. And therefore, the corresponding Hamiltonian, whose ground space is the code space, has non-commuting terms. But they're still frustration-free. And so there's, you know, lots of things and connections that people have made between quantum error correcting codes and, you know, exotic entanglement and many-body physics, you know, and things in holography. There's still a lot to be learned there, and, you know, just in the paradigm of codes with commuting checks or commuting Hamiltonians. But very little is known about what the realm of possibilities in those areas are with codes whose checks do not commute. So that alone might even be a good reason to consider what we did. Okay, so what's the state of the quantum LDPC conjecture? Here is an array of different attempts that people have made. The most interesting one here is this Bacon-Flamini-Hero-Shi code that has linear distance and, sorry, has a constant encoding rate and approaching linear distance. But it's a subsystem code for one, so it has these non-commuting gauge generators which make the code Hamiltonian frustrated. And also, you know, they don't know how to analyze the spectral gap for this Hamiltonian, so we don't know anything about the soundness of the code. And so in our work, what we achieve is approximately, so when we have this tilde over this omega, that means up to polylogarithmic factors. But up to polylogarithmic factors, we get our linear distance, constant encoding rate, and what our code is an approximate code. It's frustration-free Hamiltonian, but it's non-commuting. And on the downside, you know, our codes do not have explicit example constructions. It's based on randomized construction. And they don't have any known efficient recovery process. And so for that reason, you know, they don't at this point appear to be useful for like practical quantum fault tolerance. But, you know, hopefully we can learn other important things by thinking about this. So what's like the full definition of what we would call approximate quantum LDPC code, just to make it clear and state it again. You know, our code words are recovered with fidelity 1 minus epsilon. The code space is the ground space of a frustration-free local Hamiltonian whose terms need not commute. And the qubit interaction degree should be at worst polylogarithmic rather than constant. Everything else about it should be like a standard quantum LDPC code. So the starting point for our work was what Henry was talking about a month ago. Work by Nurki, Vazirani, and Yuan showed that you can create an approximate quantum error correcting code by taking any quantum error correcting code and you feed its encoding circuit into the Feynman-Kitaev circuit to Hamiltonian construction. And this Hamiltonian that you get has a ground space that's spanned by states of this form, and we call these history states. So let's look at the structure of it. The k qubit state that we want to encode is C. The encoding circuit for the code is this C, where these user two qubit gates, so instead of having, you know, executing our gates in parallel like you would in a normal quantum circuit here, you're doing them one at a time in sequence. And so it's a superposition basically over all possible partial encodings of our code word, where only the last branch of the superposition has the full encoding circuit applied and is therefore the full code word. And there's also these clock qubits, which count in unary, basically how many of the gates of the encoding circuit have been applied to that branch. Okay?
Yeah. Should I worry about Xi, or I can pick any Xi?
Yeah, I mean, it's just whatever you want to encode.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that's a good point. Any to find codes in this the ground space of this Hamiltonian, you pick a C, and then you build the rest of the state around it. Okay. So these history states, these are code words of the approximate code. And it's made up of n plus t qubits, where t is the length of the encoding circuit, n is the number of qubits in the underlying code. So it's important to make clear that in these constructions, what you're doing is you're taking an existing code that has its own parameters, number of qubits, you feed it into this circuit to Hamiltonian construction, and you get an approximate code that has these different code words that involve the code word of the original code. Okay. But it says that even supervision over all stages of partial encoding. And only the final term, you know, is the actual code word. So the idea that they had was if you pad the encoding circuit with identity gates, then it will be more than just the last branch of the superposition that has the fully encoded code word. You know, if you put, you know, three times more identities than the length of the encoding circuit, then three quarters of the weight of your state will actually be your fully encoded code word. So that improves the approximation parameter of the code. So you know, you can see in this diagram, you know, these are basically different stages of superposition. You know, by the time we get to here, it's only identity gates being applied, so these branches of superposition are the fully encoded code word. So if you might be wondering, why don't you take a perfectly good code to begin with and then turn it into an approximate code, what you gain by doing this is just complicated. Well, what this construction can do is you can plug in, say, a good CSS code that might have, you know, non-local checks, and the approximate code that you get out has local checks. The Hamiltonian acts locally. So that's a nice thing to be able to get. But there's a trade-off. You know, you get your local checks, but you have now a little bit of approximation here. And in this case, you know, the reason this doesn't get them an LDBC code, or even an approximate LDBC code, is that each qubit still participates in a large number of checks. So let's kind of look at what the structure of this circuit Hamiltonian that you get from the construction looks like. You know, it has initialization clock terms, which kind of enforce that, you know, your clock qubits look the way they should. The important thing is these propagation terms. And what they look like is that for each time step, you have these terms that, you know, check, okay, or is this branch at time t? If so, then let's apply the unitary ut and then increase the clock by one. And so, you know, the depth of the circuit is going to tell you how many, you know, two-qubit gates will act on any given qubit, and therefore how many terms in your Hamiltonian act on that qubit. So if your circuit is polynomial length, you'll have a polynomial number of terms acting on that qubit. Polynomial number of checks, so you know, not LDBC. And also, we don't have spatial locality here, which is a nice thing that we want. So the first thing that we do is we start with this construction and we make it approximately LDBC. So, you know, like I said, if we use a typical good CSS code that polynomial length encoding circuits, each qubit is participating in a polynomial number of checks, that's bad. But we have this result from Brown and Fauzi from 2013 that says if you make a random Clifford circuit, so in each layer you just pick two random qubits and you couple them with a random two qubit Clifford gate, and this circuit has depth log cubed n and size n log squared n, it turns out that, you know, just with this shallow depth random circuit, that circuit is with high probability the encoding circuit for a linear distance constant rate stabilizer code, which is pretty remarkable. So using this random Brown-Fauzi code construction and feeding it into the Feynman-Kataev circuit to Hamiltonian construction, we get an approximate code that inherits the good parameters from the code that we feed in. But we have this nice bonus that because the encoding circuit is shallow, it's polylogarithmic in depth, we know that each qubit will participate in order of log cubed n checks. So now, you know, we've got something that meets the approximately LDBC part of our approximate QLDBC code definition.
So just so I understand,
yeah,
these Brown and Fauzi circuits are just random circuits, and they showed that some previous paper that in polylog depth you get like decoupling and scrambling, and that's good enough for like a, I because that, that means it's a good encoding circuit. So polylog depth is going to mean polylogarithmic terms in the Hamiltonian.
That's right. And in fact, and also polylogarithmic number of terms that act on a certain any given qubit that you single it, which is an important part of the LVPC.
So like the better the scrambler, the circuit, the better the decoupler, the smaller the terms in the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think about it in terms of the scrambling, so, but yeah, if that's what that means.
So that's just like a randomized construction.
Yeah, it's totally random. You know, the code that you get, you don't really know anything about it because it's random, but you know, you know it's going to have these kinds of properties. So now all the qubits interact with all the other qubits, and there's absolutely no spatial locality. That's one of the trade-offs we get from feeding this random circuit in. Just to be clear, spatial locality was an issue before, but it's even worse now that all the qubits talk to each other. So we want to make a few more modifications to the construction. So that's where this space-time circuit to Hamiltonian construction comes in. Brickman and Terhal came up with a helpful generalization of the Feynman-Kataev construction. And so, you know, over there we saw that you take your encoding circuit and then you place a total order on your two qubit gates of the encoding circuit that you're going to execute in exactly that sequence. But instead of doing that, you can just enforce partial order enforced by causality. So what I mean by that, well, this is an encoding circuit, right? So you can't apply this gate unless both these gates have been applied already. And so you can think of these strings that you can, or membranes, or whatever you want to call them, that you can cut through the circuit like this, where what it means is every gate to the left of it has been applied, every gate to the right has not, obeys causality, is a valid partial circuit configuration. So we can take a superposition in our history states over all of these different types of partially applied configurations instead of just this strict set of partially applied configurations that obey a certain order.
Sorry, what are these paths
for the circuit? Yeah, they're just partitions of the circuit where when you draw this line, it means that the gates to the left have been applied, the gates to the right have not. So if you think about...
And we haven't used that
term
yet.
No, but so we will.
So it's sort of like a quasi surface, no?
Well,
in space time.
Maybe. Okay. So the way this works is that instead of having a global clock that just counts how far along you are in your encoding circuit like you have in the Feynman-Kataev construction over there, each qubit now has its own local clock that tells it, that tells how many of the gates that act on it have been applied. And the way you figure out which gates have been applied, you look at each qubit's local clock, and it's going to correspond to some partition of the circuit like this, where whatever's to the left has been applied, whatever's to the right has not. Okay? So this is what, it's not completely obvious, but bringing in this kind of complicated generalized construction that where we have all these partial configurations, it allows us, ends up allowing to our checks of our Hamiltonian to be spatially local in log n dimensions. And this is, in essence, why we use this partial construction. It's one of the reasons.
So,
could
you relate it to this Fermat-Fossi result? So could you have avoided this if the result of Fermat-Fossi was had locality in it?
No, because there's also just non-spatial locality in the Feynman-Kataev Hamiltonian, the way it is. I mean, it's local in like a computer science sense, where bounded number of qubits, but not spatially local. So here we get spatial locality out of this, which is nice. So this is what the history states, and therefore the code words of the approximate code look like for the space-time circuit Hamiltonian construction is very similar, except tau is this set of valid circuit configurations, so it's just all of those different kinds of lines, partitioning lines you could have drawn through the circuit, where you have a unary clock that counts which gates have been applied for each qubit. And so, obviously this is a superposition over many, many more different states than if you use just the normal Feynman-Kataev construction. And this UT is just a unitary that is all of the gates that should be applied when all your clocks are at specified to be what that vector t is. Okay? And so, this is when you're thinking about just the normal Feynman-Guittive construction, is that, you know, A and B could be applied in parallel, but in Feynman-Guittive we do it in strict sequence, so A, then B, then C. And so you can think of, you know, applying the circuit as just being, you know, a particle hopping along a one-dimensional line. You know, it starts here, nothing's been applied, once it gets to the end, all three gates have been applied in specific order ABC. But in space-time construction, it looks more like this. So we have all these kind of cuts through the circuit that tell us, you know, different partial configurations that are valid. Right, think about it. So, you know, looking at the connectivity of these gates, gate A has to be the first thing that you apply. Then after you apply gate A, you could apply gate B or gate C. But after both gate B and C are applied, only then can you apply gate D. So instead of a particle hopping on a line, applying this circuit corresponds to hopping along in this graph where you have different orders and options for getting through the end and applying everything. So if you look at the configuration, the partially applied configuration corresponding to this red slice, which means A and B have been applied, C and D have not, what should our local clocks for our four qubits look like? Qubits 1 and 2 should be at time 2 because two gates have been applied, qubits 1 and 2. And gates, their qubits 3 and 4, their clocks should read 1 because only one gate has been applied for each of those. Okay? So just to summarize what we have so far, we take a random Brown-Faustian encoding circuit on n qubits, you plug it into the space-time circuit to Hamiltonian construction, and that gives you an approximate quantum LVPC code in the sense that we've defined on n, big N, which is the number of qubits and the approximate code, as opposed to little n, which is the number of qubits for the underlying code. The number of qubits in the approximate code is n log cubed n, and that has to do with the depth of your encoding circuit, therefore how long your clocks need to be able to count for. And it inherits from the Brown-Fowsey code the good parameters up to log corrections. So its encoding is almost constant up to log cubed, has distance that's linear up to log cubed. And so, you know, things are starting to sound good.
Just so I understand, so we fix the circuit geometry, look for all these partial ordering, and then, or these lines we draw through, and that's the procedure to start the Hamiltonian?
And all the terms in the Hamiltonian are going to correspond to all those different partial, at least in the propagation part of the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian for the space-time circuit construction is going to have the same kinds of terms, except, now these terms have to be able to read all the clocks, all different qubits, and enforce causality, but that's right. Okay, so things are starting to sound good, but you know, we're not there yet. There's an important property of the code that we haven't really considered up to this point in the talk, which is the soundness of the code. So it's basically the lowest energy of a state outside the code space, or the spectral gap of the code Hamiltonian. And you know, if you just look at this at face value, it would appear that you know it might be exponentially small. And why is that? So what we actually do to analyze the spectral gap of these Hamiltonians is we look at a corresponding Markov chain on a graph that corresponds to partial applications of the circuit. So just like the one that we saw here, you take this graph that has where each node is a different allowed partial configuration of the circuit. You know, transitioning from one node to another is either applying a gate if you're going this way or undoing a gate if you're going back, right? So you can take these graphs, define a Markov chain on them. And so getting the spectral gap of the corresponding graph Laplacian will tell us basically the spectral gap of our code Hamiltonian. So that's what we want to do. And you know, the technique we would use, or want to use, is a technique called Cheeger's inequality. It would give us a lower bound on the gap. But you know, with this random two-qubit gate circuit, the analysis and sheer number of partial configurations make it seem like, you know, it's hard to do an exact analysis, and it's hard to get a bound that's anything better than exponentially small gap, and that's really bad because that would make it practically very useless, you know, be exponentially difficult to determine if a state is in the code space or not. So this is very important. So we need one more kind of piece of machinery to put in our construction. So, you know, the analysis would be simpler if instead of having this random circuit geometry, our circuit had an exact structure and qubit connectivity that we knew and could assume. So what we do is we actually take the random circuit and we uniformize the structure of it using a tool called the Bitonic Sorting Network. So what is that? So a Bitonic Sorting Network is a circuit that looks like this. This is what a Bitonic Sorting Network on 8 bits or 8 qubits look like. And you know, all of these gates are either swap gates or identity gates. And if you fill in swaps in the right places and identity in the rest, what you can do with this structure is enact any permutation of the qubits that you want. And if it's on n qubits, the depth of such a circuit is log squared n. And this comes from, you know, this is just probably the fastest parallel sorting algorithm that you can use. And so what's really important about this is that this architecture for the circuit and the qubit connectivity give us a lot of ability, a lot of structure that allows us to have a tractable analysis of the gap. So you can notice that in that architecture, each qubit interacts only with exactly log n other qubits. So let's just look back. Let's look at this qubit. Who does it interact with? It interacts with this guy, then it interacts with this guy, then it interacts with this guy. That's it. You know, there are 8 qubits, interacts with 3 guys, that's log n. And all our logarithms are these 2. So you can think of the connectivity as being that of a hypercube in log n dimensions. So what we do is we use a Bitonic sorting circuit between each layer of random gates of our Brown-Fousey encoding circuit so that the non-trivial gates always act on the same pairs of qubits. So what does this look like? So, you know, we would have, at the first, say, take some layer of your Brown-Fousey circuit, it's gonna have random gates connecting random qubits. You would put the swap gates in the right places here, and then do these swaps such that, gate 1 couples these 2 qubits, gate 2 couples these 2 qubits, 3 couples these 2 qubits, gate 4 couples these 2 qubits. And then, you know, the next layer of the Brown-Fousey circuit is gonna have completely different connectivity, so you configure this sorting network to put them all in the right places so that, again, gates act here, 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 and here. Right? And you just do this over and over again. And this seems like a lot of extra depth of routing to our circuit, but you know, it adds a factor of log squared. So instead of our encoding circuit being log cube depth, it's now log fifth depth. That's still polylogarithmic. So we still retain this polylogarithmic number of checks that our qubits are participating in.
Sorry, why do you do this sorting?
Right, so, we want to be able to analyze the spectral gap by counting and classifying and understanding all of the different partial configurations of the circuit. And if we have this random circuit architecture, it's intractable.
I see.
Right. So we use this to make it tractable. We know exactly where all of the gates are. And therefore what all the partial configurations can look like if we can analyze it properly. So schematically, this is the whole thing now. We take a Brown-Fousey code and its encoding circuit. We feed it into this, this process where we uniformize the circuit with these Bitonic sorting networks, and then we plug that resulting encoding circuit into our space-time circuit Hamiltonian construction, and that gives us our approximate quantum low density parity check code. So the important thing that's left at this point is to actually understand what the spectral gap is and make sure that we have good soundness. So the way we do this, so we want to analyze this Markov chain on this graph of partial configurations that I showed you. And it's still pretty hard, but we use a technique to make it easier, which is called an aggregate Markov chain. So we have some Markov chain, which has a stationary distribution, transition probabilities between states. And so remember, our transitions here are applying the next gate or undoing a gate, going back and forth. And a state space omega, the state space here, is just all the different valid partially applied circuit configurations. We can create a coarse-grained Markov chain by taking subsets of our state space, so subsets of circuit configurations, and the transition probabilities between these subsets are defined this way. And B is the number of different subsets that any one configuration could live in. So we define this aggregate Markov chain, and then we define restricted Markov chains on each individual subset by basically just forgetting about all the transitions that would leave that subset, but we keep everything else there. So we have those two different types of Markov chains, the coarse-grained one and the fine-grained one. And then Markov chain literature tells us that the gap of the Markov chain that we want to analyze is lower bounded by the product of the gap of the aggregate chain and the minimum gap of any of the subchains. And so that's we need to find, you know, the aggregate gap and the subchain gap. And so the way this technique looks is that, okay, so our uniformized circuit looks like this. It's just this photonic sorting network repeated over and over and over again. And you know, these red boxes are each photonic sorting networks. And so our subchains are just gonna be these sliding windows of the same width along the circuit. And so instead of being a walk on a line or a really complicated graph like we had before, it now looks like this. Now, this is the aggregate coarse grain chain from a configuration that lives entirely in the red block. By applying a gate, it might take you to the green block, or it might take you to the blue block, but no further.
Is it obvious why you cannot hop further if your sorting is, if your sorting bars are like not touching first two qubits? In principle, you could just, you know, evolve this.
Right, so that's a very good question. So an important insight about the structure of these photonic networks is that no circuit configuration can be can extend further than a single block because of the log n connectivity. So you can't just keep applying gates, like the rest of them have to catch up, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what makes any of this doable. So let's take a closer look at that. So the sub Markov chain that we need a gap for is the Markov chain of configurations of a single photonic block. So let's start there. So we need to understand the structure a little better. What are these photonic blocks? So the photonic block of rank 1 is just on 2 qubits. The photonic block of rank 2 is on 4, 3 is on 8, so it's 2 to the rank. And there's a recursive definition for how you build these circuits. Start with B1, and how do you get B2? You take two copies of B1, side by side, which are independent, and then you add one more layer that couples those two independent copies of B1. Now let's look at B3. How do you get B3? Well, notice that these two are both independent copies of this B2 circuit. And then you add a third layer that couples those two blocks. Right? And then so you can define, you know, any photonic block of any rank using this iterative construction. Right? So that's the insight here. But also, you know, so this is, you know, I spent a long time analyzing this structure, and there are a lot of surprising things that you can find. So for example, this is also important. Say you take the first two layers of the rank 3 block. That's what these are. First two layers of that guy. It doesn't look like it, but connectivity-wise, this is isomorphic to just two independent copies of the B2 block. So all of the number of different configurations that live in these two layers is actually the same number of configurations you would have for two independent B2 blocks, which is surprising. And so, yeah, whenever you have a subset of the layers of a photonic block, you can always break it into a decoupled number of blocks. So, you know, let's try and count the number of configurations you have of the photonic block of rank 3. Well, the way we can do it is by, you know, using this structure that we have that, you know, if we take a subset of the layers, it breaks into something that's easier to count, right? So as we just saw, these first two layers have the same number of configurations as two independent copies of B2. So if little b counts the number of configurations of big B, and also, you know, the last two layers of the photonic block of rank 3 are, by construction, just independent copies of B2. We can at least upper bound the number of configurations of this whole thing by counting the number of configurations of the first two layers and the number of configurations of the last two layers. It's going to overcount because we're counting twice the configurations that just live in this layer, but, you know, it gets us somewhere. So, how many configurations can we bound it with? It's b squared, so or B2 configurations for this part times B2 configurations for this part, because these two blocks are independent, plus, again, B2 times B2, so it's 2 V2 squared. And that is, and we're overcounting with that. But what you can do then is you know that you overcounted by the number of configurations of this middle layer. And, you know, for example, this middle layer is actually just isomorphic to 4 copies of B1, because it's 4 independent 2 qubit gates. So what do we do? We take our overcounting 2v2 squared and subtract b1 to the 4. And this technique holds true in general. So you get this recursion. The initial conditions are 2 and 7, because those are easy to count by hand. So this is a recursion actually with no closed form solution, unfortunately, but asymptotically, we know it looks like this. Phi is actually the golden ratio for some reason. It shows up here. And omega is 1.854. It's a transcendental number with no known closed form. Okay, so how do we make any more progress? We actually have to look at something that seems on its surface completely different, but it's related. So what is the dyadic tiling of the unit square by dyadic rectangles? A dyadic rectangle is a rectangle that has this form, say an R2. Right? And so, for example, the way we make a baton, so say we have a unit square, the way that we can create a dyadic tiling of the unit square is we first choose, okay, do we want to do an horizontal or vertical cut? We choose one and say horizontal, and then for the remaining sections now, we make the same choice, horizontal or vertical. We could say vertical here and horizontal here. This is what you would call a dyadic tiling of the unit square of rank 2. Rank 2 because we iterated this cut process twice. You know, so there's only 2 of rank 1, and they look like this, and they look like this. Rank 2, they look like all the ones here. You know, for higher rank, they look like this. So why do we care about this? Well, it turns out there's a counting isomorphism between the number of circuit configurations of batonic block of rank R and the number of dyadic tilings of unit square of rank R. And even better yet, there is a natural Markov chain on the state space of dyadic tilings of unit square, which is preserved by this counting isomorphism. So what I mean by that is that, you know, there's a way of going between these dyadic tilings. So you could pick this bisector and flip it vertical, and you would get to that dyadic tiling. So the Markov chain would be, you know, pick a bisector that if you flip it, you will obtain another dyadic tiling. And if you can, you flip it and you go to the next one. And you can't always flip any bisector that you want. For example, if you flip this horizontal bisector, you end up with something that's not a dyadic tiling, doesn't fit this form. The way you know if it's dyadic tiling or not is if you could have gotten it from this recursive process I described. But the point is, there's this Markov chain that can take you from one dyadic tiling of the same rank to another. And it is completely isomorphic to the Markov chain of moving between different partially applied circuit configurations for encoding circuit. And better yet, so this Markov chain on these dyadic tilings was a math problem that had been open for about a decade. But a few years ago, it was solved. And they found a mixing time for that Markov chain, one over which can basically give us our spectral gap. So because our partially applied circuit Markov chain is basically the same in disguise as this dyadic tiling Markov chain, this implies a spectral gap of our within block Markov chain on the partially applied configurations of the circuit of, you know, at least 1 over polynomial, specifically n to the minus 3.09. Which is related to this log base 2 of 17 number that shows up. Okay, so how does this isomorphism work? So we're going to walk through an example for a rank 3 dyadic tiling, which corresponds to a partial configuration of a rank 3 circuit. So if we start with all of the all horizontal bisected tiling, we can number subsegments of lines as follows, and match them up one to one with different gates that we can apply on our Boutonic circuit. And it turns out that whichever guys you can flip here correspond to whichever gates you're allowed to apply here that respect causality. It's a one-to-one matching. So for example, let's look at how this works. So let's decide to apply this gate first. So this qubit and this qubit are going, their clocks are going to advance one, and we flip this. Okay, what we're gonna do next, we're gonna apply this gate, which corresponded to flipping this bisector. And so now we can see that because we've applied this gate and this gate, both these qubits are at time equals one, so this gate can be applied. And the way that you can see that in our dyadic time is that basically you can flip a segment when it has been basically the things that border it, where the cut to the next segment is, have both been flipped. So if you think about it, if we flipped this segment now, we wouldn't get a dyadic tiling. You'd have this weird space. But because once we flip this guy and this guy to get here, flipping this guy will give us a dyadic tiling. And so this correspondence between gates we can and can't apply and edges we can and can't flip is perfect. And so this is one way we could proceed through fully applying the circuit, moving through partial configurations. So, you know, if a line segment is horizontal, the gate has not been applied. If the segment is vertical, it has been applied. So once we get this all vertical configuration, all the gates have been applied. So that gives us the analysis for the fine-grained Markov chain. So for the coarse grain analysis, similar techniques work. And so in the end, we can use Cheeger's inequality and similar counting techniques. And we get a gap for the aggregate Markov chain, which is 1 over polylog. And so for the whole gap, we have basically 1 over n cubed times polylog for our full code Hamiltonian. It has good soundness. So finally, second last thing, I said that our code can detect arbitrary poly errors with high probability using polylogarithmic depth circuits. So you can show that for any poly error that doesn't stabilize the code space, so you call this a non-trivial error, this is a local term, a projector in your Hamiltonian, such that the odds of detecting that error are 1 over polylog. You can use a technique from Marriott and Watrous called in-place amplification, and it allows you to turn these projectors into 10 local measurement elements, which are also projectors that have polylogarithmic circuit complexity, and for which the odds of detecting this poly error are now arbitrarily close to unity. So we can easily detect arbitrary poly errors locally, and poly errors have energy penalty 1 over polylog. And so the very last thing, what are the last ingredients that we haven't already talked about for an error-correcting code? What are the encoding and decoding circuits? Space-time code words, so that's these superpositions that have various partial completions of the encoded state in them. You can generate those using a polynomial-sized quantum circuit. If you want details for that, it's in our paper. And then how does decoding work? Well, so the underlying Brown-Fousey code is guaranteed to have a recovery map. And so what you do to decode is you just throw away the clock qubits and then use the recovery map on the data qubits. And then so the recovered state has error 1 over polylog. But because this is just some random code and we're just using the existence of this decoding map, we have no idea how to actually do decoding in principle, like in actuality, and if it's efficient, etc. So, in summary, our codes show that if we go beyond the stabilizer paradigm, we can say interesting things about quantum low-density parity check codes. And we can, in many ways, come very close to creating something that might be considered acceptable as a quantum LVDC code. If we could figure out how to do decoding, et cetera. We also came up with a new technique for the gap analysis, and you know, maybe you know, they'll be able to find application in other problems. But you can ask many questions about the space-time codes themselves. You know, could you come up with concrete examples instead of just you know, having this randomized circuit? Can we understand the logical operators, efficient decoding, and things like that? And yeah, so with that, thanks for listening. And if anybody has any questions about details that I skimmed over, or questions about you know, any part of this, I'll be here for the until the end of next week, so I'll be happy to chat. Thanks a lot.
Questions? I can start with one question. Is the locality of the terms in the Hamiltonian something you can't optimize beyond, like, at least in this construction, is there a geometric open which has log?
Which kind of, like, spatial locality?
Yeah, because the one I'm familiar with is that, like, these kind of random circuits, you can, well, so random circuits are, like, optimal in the sense that you can only, like, takes the circuit depth to get decoupling. Which I think is related to them being good like encoding circuits,
uh-huh.
is like logarithmic.
Okay.
So like Brown and Fuzzy circuits are almost optimal and they're like, optimal decouplers.
Mm-hmm.
So if that means that I can't maybe that means with the randomized construction imply that like you can't do better if the, you can't do better than the circuit depth log n, would that mean that you can't improve the locality of the terms of
the for our construction certainly. So, and the reason that we get log n spatial locality, it has to do with the fact that once we apply this Bittonic sorting network, each qubit talks to exactly log n of the qubits. And that's where our log n spatial locality comes from.
But I mean, in this construction, is like, is that optimal?
We think so.
Is there room for improvement in the other program?
Yeah, that's unclear, and maybe. And that's something that we're trying to think about, you know, whether or not we could maybe get actual LVPC, where instead of, you know, every qubit participating in a polylog number of checks, maybe we can get constant. But it's not clear how.
Other questions? All right, let's thank Tom again. And...